The best investments I've always made are in learning. In my career at AT&T, I moved to jobs that I would purposely focus on which one had the highest or steepest learning curve. It was furthest from what I was doing, and it was a different part of the company, but it really prepared me for being CEO because I really had a good feel for the entire operation.
I'm your host, Jason Raznick, founder of Benzinga, a leading platform in the financial world with the mission to level the playing field for individual investors. And this is the Raz Report podcast, where we share inspiring stories, expert advice, and exclusive perspectives to keep you ahead of the ever-changing world of investments and entrepreneurship. Let's dive into the show.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Raz Report. It's very festive in Detroit. The NFL draft is behind us. I'm excited to have a leader in wireless. You're going to learn a lot of stuff. This guy's the chairman of Akamai, CEO of Sprint, worked in wireless for years on the boards of many different companies, organizations. Dan Hesse, welcome to the Raz Report.
Thanks, Jason. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, man. Thank you for coming on. You've been through it all. I mean, you were wireless, AT&T wireless before, you know, Terrabeam. I mean, these companies, Embark, Sprint. We're going to get into all of it. But I asked you before on our pre-call, CDMA, TDMA, GSM. What technology ended up winning out on this stuff?
Well, that was we called it the religious wars back there on the standards. And the good news is they ultimately converged when we got to, you know, really 3G. Those are the 2G standards. So the G basically stands for generation for your listeners. 1G was analog, 2G was digital. And then you had three, you had GSM, which was the largest global standard. You had TDMA, which was really the US version of GSM. And then you had CDMA, which TDMA was time division, CDMA was code division. But in essence, you had Qualcomm and Irwin Jacobs, who really invented CDMA, made a big impact in North and South America and in parts of Asia. And it was best for the industry to converge the standards in 3G, and that's what happened.
Yeah, I remember I was like 22. I had like a successful online textbook business. And, but I was like, nope, the future is using your cell phone to open your hotel room door or pay for things. And this goes back 23 years ago. So I gave up on my business that was doing well. And I'm like, I got to make a cell phone, pay for things. So I went to a CTIA event or something.
Oh, yeah.
I studied wireless. I like studied CDMA. I was 22 years old, not realizing, okay, stick with what you already have that's successful, make it successful, sell it, move on to the next. But I wanted to make a cell phone to pay for things and to open my hotel room door. And I know it was 20 years before, you know, my time. And that's where, yeah, I CDMA, TDMA, Qualcomm. It was an interesting time back then, the different competing.
It really
networks.
Was. And you were well ahead of your time.
Yes, yes. So I was like 20 years. You know, you can create a business, but you got to have the timing on your side. So you're the chairman of Akamai now. Akamai, you know, is a company that in the heyday, .com darling, made your internet delivery faster. What is Akamai up to these days?
Well, that's still an important business, which is what we call the content delivery business. So if you're either watching this on a website or you're watching television, the likelihood is that Akamai technology is being used, especially to make your video experience better, you know, improve resolution, latency, and what have you. It's also a cybersecurity company and a cloud computing company. Those are the big three divisions at Akamai, and it's headquartered in Cambridge, Massachusetts, right next to the MIT campus.
Got it. And how long have you been chairman for?
I've been chairman, I think, now for maybe 3 years, and I've been on the board for about seven.
You're able to hire very smart people because you're right by, you know, very smart schools.
Absolutely. Our CEO is a PhD from MIT. And I'm always humbled whenever I go to board meetings or go to a company headquarters because everyone is smarter than me.
Yep. I think that's a good thing they say, right? Be the dumbest person in a room.
Absolutely.
So you've had a lot of success in your career. When you take us back to like the younger years, what led you down this business road? Are there any experiences from your childhood that you believe led you this way and, you know, succeed and be at the highest levels of organizations?
Well, it was really serendipity. I grew up as an Army brat. I went to 10 schools, grades 1 through 12. I went to grade school in Italy, went to high school in Germany. Then went to college. And actually, the way I started with AT&T is I was getting my MBA. I really didn't have any decent work experience. And AT&T was known at the time of having the best summer internships in the country, period. And back then, they only interviewed at Harvard and Wharton. They didn't go anywhere else. And I was at wow. I was at Cornell. So my sister lived in Boston. I asked her to go over to the Harvard Business School and just go into their kind of development office and their recruiting office and just start taking stuff, which she did and sent it to me. And the recruiter at AT&T, you know, he loved to tell the story. He's going through this big stack of applications because they're very selective. And this one jumps out to him. He sees this application from Cornell. And he was just curious because they don't, you know, they don't recruit at Cornell. He was curious. So he called me up and how did you get a hold of this application? I told him I sent my sister over. And that's really how it started the summer. I loved the summer I spent there. And then I spent 23 years at AT&T. And, you know, back then, AT&T was such an innovative company. I started working
closely. So this guy gave you your start, basically. Your sister to this guy. I mean, that's a great story.
Yeah.
That's being resourceful and creative.
Say that?
Sorry? That's being resourceful and creative to make it happen.
Yeah, that's what he liked about it. So it all worked out well. But it was no plan. It was just kind of pure luck.
That's right. Serendipity at its best. And then 23 years, AT&T gets you in this career. And then eventually you become the CEO of Sprint. But it was at a time when Sprint was going through some troubles, like around bankruptcy time, right?
I was recruited. At the time I was the CEO of Embark, which is a landline company. And it's changed its name. It's now called Lumen. It's part of what's called Lumen. But I was running a landline company and Sprint was having trouble. So I was recruited as the CEO right at the end of 2007. And I remember opening up the business plan on my very first day of the job, and the plan of record had us filing for bankruptcy in 6 months. I knew things were bad. I had no idea they were that bad. So it was a challenging first year, to put it mildly.
So, I mean, going into a company that was filing for bankruptcy in 6 months, I mean, did that give you a lot of stress to go to that versus leaving Embark, or you liked the challenge? You coveted the opportunity to prove people wrong or something?
Well, I was looking for a challenge. Had I known it was going to be that much of a challenge, even a guy like me who loves challenges probably wouldn't have taken it. So I knew the wireless business well because I had been the CEO of AT&T Wireless earlier. I knew a lot of people at Sprint. One of the reasons I took the job was both Embark and Sprint were headquartered in Kansas City. And Sprint was the big company in town. It was the anchor tenant. So, and I knew a lot of people there, and if Sprint was having troubles, you know, I wanted to do the best thing for my community. Actually, my wife really talked me into doing it, because it was the right thing to do for, you know, for the community of Kansas City. And it was a challenge that you felt I could take on, but it was more serious than it was shared with me before I took the job. We'll just leave it at that.
Okay. And then I read an article where you mentioned the importance of aligning culture with business outcomes. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So, you know, as far as, you know, kind of turning around AT&T, I'd say the CEO's role are really three main things, and you have to do it pretty quickly. One is figure out what your strategy is going to be. Number two, who your team is going to be, if you will, the what and the who. And the third is the how, which is the culture. And the challenge at Sprint was that it was a merger of equals. So you had Sprint and Nextel come together, where Sprint shareholders got 50.1% and Nextel headquarters got shareholders got 49.9%. And so you had the name Sprint Nextel. You had two headquarters. You had corporate headquarters at the old Nextel headquarters, operating headquarters at the Sprint, at the old Sprint headquarters. You had this, you kept both colors. So you had, you know, Sprint, you had both names in the name Sprint Nextel, but you went with Nextel's colors. You had half the board from Sprint, half from Nextel, the same with the senior leadership team. And what the worst thing that happened, though, is both companies had good cultures and strong cultures. But when I got to Sprint Nextel at the time, and I'd ask somebody whatever question it was, in the first two or three sentences, they told me whether they were legacy Sprint or legacy Nextel. Like, that was still their identity. I'm going, uh-oh, we've got a problem. We don't have one culture. We have two competing cultures or camps still. So, getting the culture fixed. And actually, it turned out to be an opportunity, because what I did was I told the team, the whole leadership team on a, and actually the whole management team in an all-employee meeting, pretty much what I'm just telling you, and said, look, we are not going to survive with two cultures. We need one culture. I listed great attributes of the Nextel culture, great attributes of the Sprint culture, some great attributes I had seen at other companies that were really successful. I said, okay, folks, we're going to start with a clean sheet of paper. I'm going to send out over 20 attributes of what I considered the best attributes that made strong cultures. I want your vote on what company, you know, what is the culture of the company that you want to work for and that you think is going to win. But I will tell you, I'm picking one of those items. And so you're not going to pick one. One is going to be accountability. I don't see a lot of accountability here. And that's one of the reasons that we have the issues. And also the culture, I'm accountable for that as CEO. So I have to feel comfortable. I have to feel it's right. But like a lot of things, it's not a democracy, but I want your input. So this is a good example of how we're going to run the company. I want your input. I want you to tell me what you think the culture ought to be, but I'm going to make the decision because I'm accountable for it. And that's how the culture got started. And I would say in terms of the turnaround and improvement in performance, and pretty much the whole team, I think, will tell you that, was culture was number one.
And you made the culture like measurable. Like you said, culture should be measurable like a metric. How do you do that?
Absolutely. So what we would do is every quarter, so I had these all-employee meetings, and we'd send out a questionnaire. And one of them was, we had 10 elements that made up our culture. I would ask everybody how we're doing on each metric. So it was a score on, actually, the one that we typically get, it was kind of funny, one of them was have fun. So the fun score kept going up. And so I would do these things like throw beer parties and what have you. And then I say, well, I told the team, well, fun's in good shape, so we don't have any more beer parties. People figured it out in a hurry. They started killing me on fun because they wanted the beer parties to continue. But anyway, you would measure those on a survey, but also, let's say, innovation was one. So you'd use other metrics like the number of patents that were being granted and filed for on a regular basis. Focus on customers was one of them. So the J.D. Power score, the American Customer Satisfaction Index, you know, customer satisfaction index score would go up there. So I'd have a combination in terms of measuring for, let's say, for culture, I'd get the survey of the employees on how they thought we were doing. And then I would get hard metrics to support each of them. And I would report them every quarter to the employees, just like earnings and revenue and new subscribers. It was put on a par with the other performance metrics. And so our cultural scores went up.
And how often did you guys do these surveys?
Like internal? We did to pretty much all employees once a year, and then we would take a sample of employees every quarter. So, there's a quarterly sample, but a statistically valid sample each quarter. But we would have all the employees fill out the survey once a year.
Got it. Makes sense. All right. Now you were inducted to the Wireless Hall of Fame, right?
I was.
Yeah. So, like, what specific? Looking back, like on your career, one of the questions that someone wanted me to ask you is like, what specific innovations or leadership strategies do you believe played a role in you earning, you know, such a prestigious award or being in this?
What I tried to do in my career, and what they talked about when I was inducted into the Hall of Fame, was I would apply technology in a customer friendly, usable way. So, for example, when I was the CEO at AT&T Wireless, I don't know if you remember back then, but this is like in the late 90s before we launched Digital One Rate in 1998, if I was in my hometown making a local call, it was A cents a minute. My hometown making a long distance call, it was B cents a minute. Traveling, let's say to New York, making a local call, it was C cents a minute. I was traveling, making a long distance call, D cents a minute. So we came up with this thing called, because digital was brand new, which made it much more efficient to roam, to traffic was cheaper. I said, it's going to be one rate. A minute is a minute. Just knock yourself out. So you just bought a bucket of minutes, and didn't matter if it was long distance or local or if I was traveling. That was really brought simplicity. It took off like crazy. Go to Sprint with 3G. You've got these browsers and phones, and you have smartphones coming out, the iPhone, Android devices, and what have you. We came out with something called Simply Everything, because then it was almost deja vu all over again.
Yep.
You got your bill, you had your data charges, your text charges, your voice charges, really complicated. You never knew what your bill was going to be each month. We said all in, $99 a month. It's all unlimited. Just use your phone. And then we also
that was on Sprint.
This was at Sprint. Sorry. This was at Sprint back in 2008. Yep. So fast forward exactly 10 years, pretty much. It was the same thing with the new generation. So you take the new generation of wireless, I'm just using those as examples, and take the advantages, but make it simple for the customer. Make it usable.
Yeah. And I remember, and you could be grandfathered into that plan, the Sprint thing, the $99. And then wait, did John Legere come after you, or is that another person in between?
Actually, John Ledger was a protege of mine. He worked for me at AT&T. And actually, there's a Forbes article they interviewed that, you know, John and I, and we still keep in touch. So he was after. So John was actually never at Sprint. He was at T-Mobile. So he came to T-Mobile as CEO while I was already at Sprint. So I started at Sprint before John came to T-Mobile. So we were competitors for a time. And people actually afterwards, because, you know, John, he's a great guy, but he liked the trash talk his competitors quite a bit. People go, you know, John Ledger's never said anything bad about you, Dan, never. And he would always, you know, and that was partly it. We had a relationship where I was really his mentor. I mean, he had others, but I was probably, if he had to pick number one or number two, I would probably be that person that really worked with him on his career and coached him. And he's one of the people I'm most proud of in terms of what they accomplished in their career.
So were you there when T-Mobile and Sprint merged?
No. So when I was at Sprint, we actually took a run. We talked to the regulators. It was well publicized to see if they would let us. Because at the time when I was running Sprint, Sprint was the larger company of the two. It had a higher market cap. It had more customers and what have you. So we were looking at buying T-Mobile. At that time, with that administration, they basically said, no way. So many years later, after I had retired, T-Mobile bought Sprint. So I was not there when that came together.
Got it. Okay. So interesting story on John. That's mentorship at its best.
Great story. I'm proud of him.
What is one of the, this is more of the rapid fire style now. What is one of the best or most worthwhile investments you ever made? Could be an investment of money, time, or energy.
I think the best investments I've always made are in learning. So, you know, in my career at AT&T, I moved to jobs that I would purposely focus on which one had the highest or steepest learning curve. It was furthest from what I was doing, and it was a different part of the company. And those were the investments. It was a lot of effort it would take to learn a new job, but it really prepared me for being CEO, because I really had a good feel for the entire operation.
Got it. So it was about learning and going to stuff that you were most challenged with.
Yep.
Do you actively invest in the stock market?
No, I would not say actively. I have a financial advisor, and I invest in some funds, especially ones that share my set of values. When I am investing, in a number of startups. Generally, if I really believe in the idea, or I really believe in the founder, or some of the people that are involved.
Got it. Okay. So are you actively investing in startups, or it's like when it's an interesting opportunity at the time?
More the latter. It's more active than I'd probably like it to be, because
that's where I'm at. That's,
you know, I'm maybe an easy mark. So a lot of people come my way. But I'd say I would not say I'm active. No.
Yeah. I did a period of time of a bunch of startups, but now I'm like, all right, I invest in, you know, real estate. I want some income, you know?
Well, my number one startup, and I'm actually chairman now, is my two sons quit their corporate jobs about a year ago to start a company together. And they asked me to be non-executive chairman. So that's a startup that I am particularly involved in. Pardon?
What is it?
It's called Land Party. You can go to landparty.com and look it up, but it is a platform that allows gamers to get together and hang out together. They used to have Land Parties where people would bring their computers over. They might be watching television together, let's say the Chiefs game or the Lions yep. game or whatever it is, and play different and look over each other's shoulders as they play different games. They might play with each other the same game, but they can do it in a virtual environment. It's pretty cool. And they have a U.S. patent on it.
I'm going to ask my son. He's a little bit of a gamer. Okay. Do you have a favorite quote or piece of advice you received that was a real game changer for you?
Well, you know, the bosses, I would say that, and actually it came up in a conversation I had. I also, by the way, have a radio show and podcast called The Mentors Radio. My guest this
week, you do.
Was Shelley Lazarus, the former CEO of Ogilvy. And we talked about authenticity. And from the very first boss I had, and I was very fortunate to have really great mentors. It's just be yourself, be authentic. You just always be yourself. And that I would, I try to give the same advice to everyone else.
Got it. Who would you say, or is there someone that you would consider the most successful person of all time? Maybe in the wireless space or just in general? I don't know.
Boy, that's a tough one. The person that I mean, when I think of who's the greatest person of all time, to me, it's Abraham Lincoln, because of the change that he made in this country and the way he kept it together. Instead of dividing the country, he knew it was important that this country come together. And he was a man, you know, cost him his life. But if I had to pick number one, it would be Abraham Lincoln.
That's a good one. What was your first, and I think I already know the answer. What was your first, or maybe I don't, because you could have worked when you were younger. What was your first or worst job?
Well, probably my worst job was cleaning sewers in Brooklyn, New York.
Why were you doing that?
Well, it paid really well. It was a union job. I was going to college, and my dad was stationed at Fort Totten, which is an army fort in Queens. And I got a job cleaning the sewers. And back then, this is of course the early 70s. It's $10 an hour. That's a lot of money. You can clear $4,000. So it was a really dirty, hard job, but it paid well. So that's why I did it. And I was very happy to have it.
And the smells didn't bother you?
Oh, the thing is, after about 2 weeks, you didn't smell it anymore. But our garage at the fort was up behind the house. And so my mother couldn't see me when I would come home from work. I would drive, but she could smell me when I was back. She could smell the garage, which was like a half a block away. Everybody else. And so I had to take all my clothes off in the garage.
Yep.
And then I'd put it down. And then I would go shower because I just smelled it. But your own nose, you don't smell it after a couple of weeks. But it's really bad.
Wow. Well, I had I have a friend. She can't smell at all. Like she has some like a thing where she has no ability to smell. That would have been a good mom for you because she wouldn't be able to smell you. You know? That's great. Where do you live now?
In Scottsdale, Arizona, about 7 months a year, and in Kansas City, which is where my two sons, my daughter-in-law and granddaughter live, which is, you know, where Sprint was headquartered.
Very nice.
So when my youngest went away to college, we came down to Scottsdale for the summer months. So that's where I am right now, but we'll head back soon to Kansas City.
And we're still on, but yeah, my family and I would go to the Phoenician there every 2 years for spring break. Do you go to any Suns games or not a Suns fan?
I'm a big Suns fan. I'm a big NBA fan. I go to a few. I hope to go see a playoff game. And the other NBA team we're big fans of are the Oklahoma City Thunder because they were the closest team to Kansas City.
I was at the Lions Kansas City game, the first game of the season last year in Kansas City. I was there.
Well, the one you guys won.
Yes, yes.
Well, I was at the Super Bowl in Las Vegas, and the year before at the Super Bowl in Phoenix.
I was at 49ers. I was in San Francisco with the Lions 49ers that we should have won. I was on the field. We would have won. It would have been unbelievable. We have this NFL event here in 2 days. A bunch of players are coming, you know, big names. So you're a sports fan. Okay, well, there's something I'll say to you after the podcast, but not yet. And then this is probably the last question. What is the biggest challenge you faced in the last few years, and how did you overcome this? Something?
Well, the biggest challenge, and we've hit on it a little bit, was getting to Sprint and turning that big ship around. As I mentioned earlier, it was just picking the right people. A lot of people had to leave and change and come in, but you do it in a very constructive, positive way because a lot of folks just weren't in for the war we were going to be in for the next few years. But without question, the toughest challenge was turning Sprint around. And the culture was number one, and a culture really focused on the customer experience and kind of going from last to first, and customer satisfaction was really the key to turning the company around.
And that was, and then one of the keys to that, to make it more, you know, transparent, was making the pricing super simple.
Exactly. Simplicity was really the brand. You know, I didn't talk about the strategy, but it was the customer experience, the brand, and cash, which were expenses. On the brand side, when I got to Sprint, we really didn't have a clear brand position. Verizon was the network. Can you hear me now? AT&T was the iPhone. They were the only company with the iPhone. T-Mobile was low price. We really didn't have one. And with 3G and smartphones coming on, the white space for us from a brand point of view was simplicity, because it was really complicated. The devices were complicated, and the bills were even more complicated. So that was what we really brought, was this notion of simplicity. And you say the rate plan made a big difference, where, geez, I don't want the headache. I know it's going to be $99 a month, and I can just use anything on the phone, go to any app, surf all I want.
Got it. And that's where you guys position yourself. Because I remember Sprint, I'm like, I'm not going to get Sprint because the quality is not going to be as good as AT&T. Or that's what I was thinking. And I know now it's very confusing. I mean, Verizon, I use Verizon, but there's another brand like Visible that uses Verizon's network, and that's half the price. So why don't I just go to Visible? I haven't, but I don't know. I don't know why I have Verizon, but I have Verizon. I'm not sure why. Like, I don't have a loyalty to Verizon, but I use Verizon. So I don't know what that means. One more question. What advice, and if it's the thing about taking the job that's the hardest that you don't know, then we don't have to go to it. But what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
That's a really good one. I would say, focus on your friends and family that you're going to have in your career. So many demands for your time, but what sustains you in life, not only in terms of your enjoyment during your career, but especially once you retire, are the relationships and the friendships that you've built over the years. And of course, especially with your family. So the relationships with my sons and my family, that spending the time with them and my spouse has made all the difference. But my best friends are people that I worked with during my career, even my competitors, like the Wireless Hall of Fame, we get back together. And that's one of the reasons I'm in, is my competitors basically were the ones that voted me in. You build these relationships and focus on that, because as you look back on your career, especially in retirement, for like an old guy like me looking back, that's what you remember, is you remember the people.
Got it. I wish in 2001 you could have hit me in the head though, Dan, and say, hey, you're not, the world is not ready for paying for your food or your hotel rooms with your phone, because I did get passionate with that. And that's why you're non-exec chairman of Land Party. You spend more time with your family. And there was something else you made me think about. So you're saying focus with your family and friends. So these days, Akamai is taking a lot of your time?
It is. And I'm also, I chair the technology committee at PNC, which is a bank that's headquartered in Pittsburgh. I'm a big music and stereo equipment nut. So actually one of the things that I'm most proud about my wireless career was bringing high fidelity sound to mobile devices, mobile phones.
You did that?
The HTC, what was called One M8, Harman Kardon edition. I brought Qualcomm in, HTC, Harman Kardon, Sprint, Spotify. We really made a great sounding phone. It's actually the only mobile device that's ever been recognized by the Absolute Sound as a must-have, a recommended device. And it really changed the way music, the quality of music over devices. But I digress. So I write for Neil Young's website. He has Neil Young Archives. He has a listening section, and I write the audio columns there. That's a real love of mine. And I do the Mentors Radio podcast, which is another way of giving back, where I have an opportunity to talk to people who had good careers in sports or in business or somewhere else, and let them share their life lessons.
All right. This is awesome. All right. This is Dan Hesse, the guy, wireless king. I mean, the stories that we learned here today, there's so many different parts and parcels that you got to take out. But this, like, going to the thing that challenges you the most is probably one of the things that most people don't do. They go to what's easy. And I think that separates you. I mean, and then applying to AT&T for the intern program from Cornell and having a sister get the things, like, creative and resourceful. So, Dan Hesse, thank you for coming on the Raz Report. We appreciate it. And look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you, Jason. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.